Scriptures, but if you're visiting with us, we're especially glad that you're here. As I mentioned before, a lot of times on Wednesdays, my mind is other places, and I often find I have to refocus my mind on what it is that I plan to teach that evening. And this morning I found myself, and if you'll permit me just a small departure before we get into our lesson this morning, or this evening. There's a couple things that happened to me on the way to work this morning that just kind of stuck in my head. It's one of those things that just kind of gets in your head and you can't quite get it out. So one of the ways I do that is I just talk about it. And as I was listening to the radio on the way to work this morning, the first thing that I remember hearing was about the death of Stephen Hawking. And I don't know if any of you know anything about him. He's a great physicist, or the world would say he's a great physicist. As I was thinking about that, and I happened to remember that, you know, I think I've heard some quotes that Hawkins has given over the course of time that indicate what his religious views are. And so I looked up a few of those, and I want to share those with you. Now, hopefully I'll make my point and we'll move on. First quote, "We're just an advanced breed of monkeys on a minor planet on a very average star. But we can understand the universe. That makes us something very special." There's a fundamental difference between religion, which is based on authority, and science, which is based on observation and reason. Science will win because it works. We are each free to believe what we want. And it's my view that the simplest explanation is there is no God. No one created our universe, and no one directs our fate. Before we understood science, it was natural to believe that God created the universe. But now science offers us a more convincing explanation. And I thought about those, and I thought about, you know, here it is, the world, and they're mourning the loss of this man, and they're talking about how great he was, and how much he lended to science, and how all his theories are so great and wonderful. But then I thought about these quotes and his view of the world and his view of God, his view of religion, and how when he looked at the world, he didn't see God at all. Which kind of then brought me to the second thing that happened to me on my way to work this morning. As I'm driving down Highway 72, and it's still before sun up, the sun's starting to rise, it's still kind of dusky dark, and I get to a certain point in the road, and from somewhere up far to my right, all of a sudden the hawk dives across both lanes of 72 with its talons outstretched and lands at something that I can't see in the median. And I pass the hawk, I look over, glance at it, see it, looks like it's struggling with something in the median. And as I pass on by, I look in the rearview mirror and I see its great wings take it up out of the median, back up to wherever it was perched. And I'm thinking to myself, how can anybody just witness what I saw and think there is no God? I couldn't see anything in the median, yet a hawk that's way across the road from me at some height that I couldn't see had spotted something and had darted across, landed on it, and had taken back its meal for the day. And the very thought that all that happened by chance and there was no creator and no designer in that was just impossible for me to think about. You know, it's obvious that there had to be some design to that. That just didn't happen by happenstance. The fact that that hawk in the dusky morning light could see something that far away and then have the ability just to pounce on it just to me speaks volumes about God. Yet this man that had spent his whole life studying the universe and coming up with all these great theories couldn't see God anywhere. And the one verse that came to my mind, and I'll read this and then we'll move on for the night, was 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 26 through 29. It says, "For consider your calling, brothers. Not many of you were wise according to worldly standards. Not many were powerful. Not many were of noble birth. God chose what is foolish in the world to shame the wise. God chose what is weak in the world to shame the strong. God chose what is low and despised in the world, even things that are not, to bring to nothing things that are, so that no human being might boast in the presence of God." God chooses the wise, you know, the foolish things of this world to shame those that are wise. And it's a lesson for us, I think. Something to think about. Like I said, I didn't want to spend too much time on that. Probably spent more than I should. But it's just one of those things that I carried with me most of the day. And I thought, well, maybe one way I can kind of get that out of my mind is to share it with you all. It's something to think about and just something to contemplate as you go through the world and you encounter people that say there is no God and they can't see God anywhere around them. Anyway, so here we are in Exodus chapter 23 and we're dealing with God and we're dealing with God's laws for His people. And when we left off on Sunday morning, there in about verse 14 is where I'd like to pick up this evening. Where God says, three times you shall keep a feast to me in the year. You shall keep the feast of unleavened bread. You shall keep unleavened bread 7 days. You shall eat unleavened bread 7 days as I command you at the time appointed in the month of Abib. For in it you came out of Egypt. None shall appear before me empty. And the feast of harvest, the first fruits of your labor, which you have sown in the field, and the feast of ingathering at the end of the year, when you have gathered in the fruit of your labors from the field. Three times in the year, all your males shall appear before the Lord God. You shall not offer the blood of my sacrifice with leavened bread, nor shall the fat of my sacrifice remain until morning. The first of the first fruits of your land you shall bring into the house of the Lord your God. You shall not boil a young goat in its mother's milk. So, just a few things I want to note about these verses. Here God only mentions three feasts. I think as we go on in time, and I think there will end up being something like seven. It's interesting. He mentions the Feast of Unleavened Bread, but he really doesn't mention Passover, which we know has already been established by this time. So I find that kind of interesting that just these three events, and you know how Passover ties into the Feast of Unleavened Bread, and maybe it's meant to be understood that way, but it's not called out specifically. The idea of not offering the blood of the sacrifice with leavened bread, once again, that prohibition against leaven. The idea of the first fruits belonging to God is there. And then this kind of a odd statement in some degree is the idea of not boiling a young goat in its mother's milk. And there's numerous ideas about that. I hesitate to share any of them in great detail because there seems to be a lot of disagreement about it. One of the arguments that I did read that I will share briefly is the idea that a mother shouldn't have anything to do with the death of a child. And the idea, even that's even true in nature, was one idea that one of the commentators put forth. One of them thought it had more to do with some pagan traditions that were going on in the land at the time. I think both of those are possibilities. Anybody have any comments on those verses 4 through 19 there before we move on? Okay, if not, let's pick up there in verse 20 and we'll read a few verses here. It says, "Behold, I send an angel before you to keep you in the way and to bring you into the place which I have prepared. Beware of him and obey his voice. Do not provoke him, for he will not pardon your transgressions, for my name is in him." There's a lot of speculation about who this angel was, who this messenger from God was. It runs the gamut. Some want to correlate that with Christ. Others, you know, think it, you know, one of the other angels that perhaps is mentioned in the Bible. We're not told. And I don't really want to put a lot of emphasis on it because, you know, I feel like if it was really something that God wanted us to spend a lot of time on us, he would have probably told us who this angel was. Let's read on a little bit and we'll come back and we'll talk about this passage of scripture. Verse 22. "But if you indeed obey his voice and do all that I speak, then I will be an enemy to your enemies and an adversary to your adversaries. For my angel will go before you and bring you into the Amorites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Canaanites, the Hivites, the Jebusites, and I will cut them off. You shall not bow down to their gods, nor serve them, nor do according to their works, but you shall utterly overthrow them and completely break down their sacred pillars. You shall serve the Lord your God, and he will bless your bread and your water, and I will take sickness away from your midst of you. No one shall suffer miscarriage or be barren in your land. I will fulfill the number of your days. I will send my fear before you. I will cause confusion among all the people to whom you come, and will make all your enemies turn their backs to you. And I will send hornets before you, which shall drive out the Hivite, the Canaanite, the Hittite from before you. I will not drive them out from before you in 1 year, lest the land become desolate and the beasts of the field become too numerous for you. Little by little I will drive them out from before you until they have increased, until you have increased and you inherit the land. I will set your bounds from the Red Sea to the Sea Philistia, and from the desert to the river, for I will deliver the inhabitants of the land into your hand, and you shall drive them out from before you. You shall make no covenant with them, nor with their gods. They shall not dwell in your land, lest they make you sin against me. For if you serve their gods, it will surely be a snare to you. And that was rather lengthy reading, but I want to go ahead and read and think about all these verses as kind of a single thought, or really multiple thoughts about these verses. The idea that God, once again, he's demanding obedience, and it's interesting, you know, we've already encountered in Exodus chapter 19 and verse 8 where the people have agreed to do all that the Lord has said. We're going to see that again in the next chapter, in chapter 24, verse 3, and chapter 24, and verse 7. And if you were to look over to Deuteronomy in chapter 5, I believe it is, verse 27, it would even give you the indication there as Moses is retelling the story about the giving of the Ten Commandments. Let's turn over there and read that. There in verse 27, where the people are telling Moses, says, you go near and hear all that the Lord our God may say, and tell us all that the Lord our God says to you, and we will hear and do it. So, and this, the context of this is right after that appearing on Mount Sinai and the giving of the Ten Commandments. So several times here we've already seen a commitment from this people to do what the Lord has said. And that's, you know, God is basically reiterating that's what he expects of the people here as he talks about his angel and the angel going before him. The other thing I want you to think about is there in verse 24, and it says, you shall not bow down to their gods, nor serve them, nor do according to their works, but you shall utterly overthrow them and completely break down their sacred pillars. And of course, we know the story of Israel, and we know what happens with that. But if you look over to Judges chapter 3, Judges chapter 3, beginning there in verse 1, it says, now, these are the nations which the Lord left that he might test Israel by them. That is, all who had not known any of the wars in Canaan. This was only so the generation of the children of Israel might be taught to know war, at least those who had not formerly known it, namely five lords of the Philistines, all the Canaanites, the Sidonians, the Hivites who dwell in Mount Lebanon, and Mount Baal Hermon at the entrance of Hamath. And they were left that he might test Israel by them to know whether they would obey the commandments of the Lord, which he had commanded their fathers by the hand of Moses. Thus the children of Israel dwelt with the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, the Jebusites, and they took their daughters to be their wives and gave their daughters to their sons, and they served their gods. So the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord. They forgot the Lord, their God, and served the Baals and the Asherahs. Therefore, the anger of the Lord was hot against Israel, and he sold them in the hand of Cushan-Rishathaim, king of Mesopotamia, and all the children of Israel served Cushan-Rishathaim 8 years. So we see here already that God left some of these people in the land to see if the children of Israel would drive them out and not serve their gods, but yet they did serve their gods and gave their daughters to be wives and took their, you know, wives for their sons from the daughters of the people of Canaan. I thought about that, and then I also thought about what we see with Solomon over in 1 Kings chapter 11, where, turn over there and just read a few verses there. First Kings chapter 11, verse, start about verse 5. For Solomon went after Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Sidonians, and after Milcom, the abomination of the Ammonites. Solomon did evil in the sight of the Lord, and he did not fully follow the Lord as did his father David. But Solomon built a high place for Chemosh, the abomination of Moab, on the hill that is east of Jerusalem, and for Molech, the abomination of the people of Ammon. And he did likewise for all his foreign wives who burned incense and sacrificed to their gods. So the Lord became angry with Solomon because his heart had turned from the Lord God of Israel, who had appeared to him twice. And he commanded him concerning this thing that he should not go after other gods, but he did not keep what the Lord had commanded. Therefore the Lord said to Solomon, because you have done this and have not kept my covenant and my statutes, what I have commanded you, I will surely tear the kingdom away from you and give it to your servant. So you say, okay, you read all that. What's your point? And the point is this. God had repeatedly warned this people, and will repeatedly warn this people, against leaving the Canaanites in the land, against worshiping their gods, against taking their Canaanite children to be spouses to their children. But they didn't heed the warnings. And I think about how different the history of the children of Israel might have been had they heeded the warnings. You go back to the passage we just read about Solomon. Israel was at the height of its wealth and its kingdom. What would have been different about Israel had Solomon not fallen into that temptation to serve the other gods, to take all the foreign wives? And of course, the lesson for us is obvious. What all sins do we have warnings about in the scriptures? And the question is, are we listening? Are we listening to the things that God says, flee that, don't do that, don't participate in that? Or are we continuing to see, well, you know, I'm walking on this side of the cliff, but I'm over here kind of close. How close do we want to be? And something to think about, and as I look at the promises associated with following God's will, there in verse 25, it says, he will bless your bread and your water. He will take sickness away from your midst. No one shall suffer miscarriage or be barren in your land. I will fulfill the number of your days. I will send my fear before you, and I will cause confusion among all the people to whom you come, and will make all your enemies turn their backs to you. All these promises they had from God, what they had to do was serve Him and obey His commandments. All these promises we have from God today, we have a hope of a home in heaven. All we have to do is follow Him and obey His will. Questions or comments about that? You know, I've done an awful lot of talking tonight. So anybody have any questions or comments about really any of those verses there at the end of chapter 23? And what did God tell Samuel? When they're not rejecting you, they're rejecting me. And that's the reason why, right? He had already promised all those things that they were asking for.
It's hard for me to keep in my mind. These people come out of Egypt. They were slaves. They weren't warriors. And yet God tell them, says, okay, you're coming up to this land, you've got to drive these people out. So thinking in their minds, like, we're not these big warrior people that's going to be driving this out. And we do the same thing maybe today. We don't rely on God's power, His ability to help with those battles.
Yeah.
People just do that.
Yeah. And, you know, as you're saying that, I'm thinking about, you know, it's not going to be that much longer that they're going to get to the edge of the land and they're going to send in the 12 spies. And 10 are going to come back and say, yeah, it's a great land, but there are giants there. There's fortified cities there. We, slaves out of Egypt, can't do that. In spite of the promises, which is the point you're making today. You know, we have promises today in how much trust and, you know, in the year that we're focusing on faith, as we've said before, the lesson there for us is how much faith do we really have and how willing are we to demonstrate that faith? How far are we willing to go to demonstrate that faith? How strong is it? And that's very true. So as we pick up and we get into chapter 24, it says there in verse 1, "Now he said to Moses, 'Come up to the Lord, you and Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, and 70 of the elders of Israel, and worship from afar. And Moses alone shall come near the Lord, but they shall not come near, nor shall the people go up with him.' So Moses came and told the people all the words of the Lord and all the judgments, and all the people answered with one voice and said, 'All the words of the Lord, all the words which the Lord has said, we will do.' And Moses wrote all the words of the Lord, and he rose early in the morning and built an altar on the foot of the mountain and 12 pillars according to the 12 tribes of Israel. And he sent young men of the children of Israel who offered burnt offerings and sacrificed peace offerings of oxen to the Lord. And Moses took half the blood and put it in basins, and half the blood he sprinkled on the altar. Then he took the book of the covenant and read in the hearing of the people, and they said, 'All that the Lord has said we will do, and be obedient.' And Moses took the blood, sprinkled it on the people, and said, 'This is the blood of the covenant which the Lord has made with you, according to all these words.'" So, here we have Moses, and Moses has gone up to the Lord. He's come back to the people, and he speaks all these things that God would have them do. And on two occasions here, like I said before, in verses 3 and verses 7, they're committing to serve the Lord. And so we see, you know, sacrifices, and we see Moses take some of the blood from the sacrifices, and he sprinkles it on the people. And he says, "This is the blood of the covenant which the Lord has made with you, according to all these words." So their agreement, the sprinkling of the blood, I couldn't help but in my mind draw the correlation where he says, you know, "This is the blood of the covenant," to what Jesus said on the night that he introduced the Lord's Supper there in Matthew chapter 26, verses 27 and 28. When he took the cup and gave thanks and gave it to them, saying, "Drink from it, all of you. For this is the blood of the new covenant, which is shed for many for the remission of sins." And kind of that parallel between those two events, between the old and the new covenant. And it's, you know, it's interesting here to see, as I was reading through the list of the host of characters, if you will, that participate in this event and go up on the mountain. We see Aaron, we see Nadab and Abihu, we see 70 of the elders of Israel. And they go up and they worship from afar. And as we get into the next part of this chapter, we're going to see even more of that. And we'll have a little more comments about that as we get into verses 9 through 11. So questions or comments about, and I know I covered that rather quickly there, that first, about 8 verses of chapter 24.
You know, this is, but problem,
Well, and I mean, the parallel is when each of us come and we're baptized into Christ, are we not really each one of us saying, "All the Lord has said, I will do"? I mean, that's really the commitment that we make, right? When we enter into that baptism, and we rise a new creature, and we begin that walk. And as we start that walk, and we maybe stray, and I think, you know, that's kind of what you're talking about, is how is it that some people, they walk that walk pretty well, and some of, and I think, what's your level of commitment? What are you willing to endure? And obviously, I think that answer is different for each of us, right? Some of us have a very strong level of commitment. I've seen brethren over the course of time that maybe I thought, well, you know, maybe their commitment's maybe not as strong as they need to be. Maybe they didn't realize when they entered into that covenant with God what it truly meant to enter into that commitment, into that covenant. They didn't realize what they would have to sacrifice, and when they get down the road a little piece, they say, well, you know, I'm really not willing to give that up. Or, boy, that's a lot harder to give up than what I thought it was going to be. And with the children of Israel, and this happens to people as well, part of it is, what baggage did you bring with you when you entered into that covenant? And to some degree, I think, you know, God will use the term in some of the, you know, the coming chapters is about being a stiff-necked people. And I think they kind of brought that to that covenant with them. You know, that isn't something that happened after they entered into that covenant. They brought that attitude with them. That idea of being stiff-necked, rebellious. And I don't know, that's some of the, and I'll open it up to other people and their thoughts on that, but that's some of the things I think about. Is what is your level of commitment? What are you willing to endure to reach the goal? Other comments about that? And, you know, the point is, and as you just made, I can't bring this to me on Sunday and bring this with me on Sunday and Wednesday, open it and read it, take it home, lay it on the shelf, grab it before I come back out to the next service and expect to get closer to God. If I'm not praying, if I'm not reading this on a daily basis. And the other thing I thought about is, if I'm not removing from my life those negative influences, is the other thing that I think a lot of times when people come to Christ, they want to rise up out of the water and then they want to go place themselves right back in the same position they were before they entered into the waters of baptism with the same friends and the same habits. Well, if you have the same friends and the same habits, you're going to fall back into the same sinful pattern you were before you came to Christ. It's, I think, part of that as well. Yeah. That's me talking to you. Most of what I say up here, I'm talking to myself as much as I'm talking to you all. It's those are things that I know I need to be doing. So as we continue on here in chapter 24, and I'm just going to read the rest of the chapter and make a few comments in the minutes that we have left. It says, "Then Moses went up also, Aaron, Nadab, and Abihu, and the 70 of the elders of Israel, and they saw the God of Israel. And there was under his feet, as it were, a paved work of sapphire stone, and it was like the very heavens in his clarity. But on the nobles and the children of Israel, he did not lay his hands. So they saw God, and they ate and drank. And the Lord said to Moses, 'Come up to me on the mountain and be there, and I will give you tablets of stone and the law and the commandments which I have written, that you may teach them.' So Moses arose with his assistant Joshua, and Moses went up to the mountain of God. And he said to the elders, 'Wait here for us until we come back to you. Indeed, Aaron and Hur are with you. If any man has a difficulty, let him go to them.' Then Moses went up into the mountain, and the cloud covered the mountain. Now the glory of the Lord rested on Mount Sinai, and the cloud covered it 6 days. And on the seventh day he called to Moses out of the midst of the cloud. The sight of the glory of the Lord was like a consuming fire on the top of the mountain in the eyes of the children of Israel. So Moses went into the midst of the cloud and went up on the mountain. And Moses was on the mountain 40 days and 40 nights." Just a couple of comments on these last remaining verses in the minutes that we have left. The idea to me that Nadab and Abihu go up on that mountain, and it says they see God. And of course, you know, we've already referenced the passage over in Exodus chapter 33 and verse 20 where Moses wants to look on God's presence. And, you know, it said, you know, no man can look on the face of God and live. And trying to reconcile that verse to what happens here, they see something. I don't know what they see. I don't know. Obviously, it's not the face of God that's referenced over in chapter 33. It's some physical representation of God. Perhaps something like a man, because it references the feet there in chapter 10. I mean, verse 10 of chapter 24. It says, you know, the under his feet were a paved work of sapphire stone. So this blue stone that has some unbelievable clarity to it. But the idea of Nadab and Abihu being there, witnessing that, having seen all that they saw, but yet we will see over in Leviticus chapter 10, and John just referenced this in one of his lessons, them failing to reverence God as they should. And being a witness to all that, seeing all that, but yet failing to give God the proper reverence. And I think that's something that speaks to me, I guess, when I think about that, is I can't just read this and not let it have an impact on me. I've got to realize that God is a God to be feared, and that He is a God to be respected. He is a God to be obeyed. And I've got to do more than just read that. I've got to understand that and apply that to my life. That's one of the lessons I get from looking at this passage of Scripture. And the idea of, you know, Moses going up, he's approaching God, and he's given direction there to Aaron and to Hur and to the elders, you know, there in verse 14, wait here for us until we come back. And he says, you know, Aaron, Hur are with you. He's basically placing them in charge. And he's going up on this mountain to be with God for 40 days and 40 nights. And everything that has already transpired in the previous chapters and the commitment that people have already agreed to make to God and knowing how the story ends. And it's something to think about. And we'll get into more to that. And probably, you know, next week as we get into the chapter or to lesson 10, we're going to be talking more about the articles of the tabernacle and the tabernacle itself. We've got basically four more classes before this quarter's over, so I'm going to try to figure out how to best weave all the rest of these in the time that we have left. But the plan is on Sunday to get into lesson 10. Anybody have any comments about chapter 24 before we finish up tonight? If not, we'll plan on entering into chapter 25 on Sunday and be ready to start into lesson 10. I appreciate your comments.